All right. Okay, let's get started, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the final of the concurrent sessions today. Interesting topic by Mark and Basim called Death by Data. Commonly the 2 p.m. slots known as the graveyard slot, so it could be a could be an interesting one. So at the end of the session, if you can remember to fill in your feedback forms. If you do ask a question, please come to the microphone and state your name and company, as this is being recorded. There are still competitions taking place outside, and there's still the ideas board. If you have any suggestions for the profession to try and solve, it'd be good if you can put things up there. So to introduce our speakers, Mark Maher is a manager at Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants. He grew up in South Africa, qualified, and then spent a number of years working in the UK before moving here to Australia. He has experience in a wide range of areas, including traditional life insurance, reinsurance, banking, and general statistical analysis. Mark has a key interest in ensuring that actuaries remain relevant and was a co-author on the Actuaries Institute Green Paper on the impact of big data on the future of insurance. And Basim Morris, who's a member also of Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants, he's in the team in Sydney and has a focus on enabling businesses to use analytics to realise the power of data. Basim worked in London for 10 years as an independent risk analytics consultant to some of Europe's Asia and Australia's largest financial institutions, as well as holding a management position at Deloitte UK. Outside of work, Basim enjoys playing, watching and talking about football, which some of you might call soccer. Tells me he supports Arsenal, as does Mark. And Basim is also an expert nappy changer with a six-month-old client at home. So without further ado, I'll ask Mark to come to the stage first and maybe just start off by telling you how his presentation or their presentation will make you think differently, and we can all look forward to hearing about death by data. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the intro, Douglas. And thank you, everyone. As Douglas said, this is the graveyard shift, so we hope to keep you awake longer than a few minutes. But if you have to doze off, if last night was big, that's okay. I'll forgive you. So we talk about death by data and why death by data? Why are we going to make you think differently? So we've obviously heard a number of analytics presentations over the years. We heard one yesterday. So if this was just another analytics presentation, it might be death by analytics presentations. But what we wanted to do was actually look at it a bit differently from a slightly less technical angle and rather look at how we can use analytics not only to predict outcomes but actually to influence outcomes. So we heard yesterday, this morning, the talk on mental health saying how can we actually get involved to help claimants, to help get them off claim? How can we intervene to make them return to work? So it's changing the mindset of where we come in. And there's a whole risk management life cycle, and it's not only coming in at the end and paying a claim where we can be involved as insurers. There's a lot else we can do to intervene and to potentially change outcomes. So a little bit of advice from Mr. Einstein. So what are we going to be talking about? So a little bit of background. We'll talk about insight-driven organizations, what that means, and very briefly, what is analytics? Then are we winning? So as I said, we've been talking about analytics for years now. Everyone's been doing it, but are we actually getting the results that we require to drive our businesses forward? And what we'll see is that whilst everyone's been doing it, it's actually really difficult to put into action and to get tangible value from analytics. And then we're going to start on the path of encouraging you to think differently, as I said, to try influence outcomes. So we're going to give a couple of examples of this, in particular using ideas of behavioral economics, so in insurance as a service and behavioral science. And then finally, we'll talk about a couple of common pitfalls and things to avoid, things to look out for in order to avoid death by data. So a little bit of a background. Insight-driven organization. So there is a push these days for all organizations, not just insurers, to be what's known as an insight-driven organization. So basically your organization needs to be driven by information and insight and data. And why is that? Obviously there's a lot of economic pressures to gain efficiencies, changing market dynamics, a lot of data is becoming available, analytics techniques and tools and computational ability, processing power. This is all available now for us to take advantage of. So really what we need, and in order for companies to grow, and in particular insurers, is we need to ensure the right people have access to the right information at the right time to make the right decisions. So that's a drive towards analytics. So very briefly, in its simplest form, what is analytics? It is the process of transforming data into insight that can be acted upon. So there's a number of different forms of analytics, and I'll very briefly take you through what they are, because it's to prove a point which I'll say at the end. So there is descriptive analytics. This is sort of backward-looking at the past, what happened, why did it happen. It's fairly diagnostic, so helps gain insight from historical data. Then you've got predictive analytics. So that's what is likely to happen. So it employs some forms of predictive modeling to study recent and historical data, and thereby allowing you to make predictions about the future. So basically, you take data you have to predict data you don't have. Finally, you've got prescriptive analytics. And this is sort of what should be done. So it recommends decisions using optimization and simulation, etc. So it goes beyond descriptive and predictive analytics and models by recommending one or more courses of action. So it shows the likely outcome of each course and therefore helps you optimize the future. So why are we looking at this? Because about 80% of business analytics today is actually the first one, that descriptive analytics. So most analytics is actually more just looking at what happened in the past and less so looking at how we can influence the future. So, in Charlie Sheen's words, are we hashtag winning? So we developed an analytics maturity curve, and the curve itself is not very important, but we used this when I was when I did that green paper we spoke about that was released late last year. We did a survey where we asked people, where do you sit, where does your analytics function sit on the maturity curve? So from stage one, initial sort of basic reporting, Excel spreadsheets, etc. So very basic versions of descriptive analytics up through to stage five, which is leading, where organizations using real-time data to drive real-time decisions, including optimizing those decisions. So as we saw, you know, sort of prescriptive analytics. And as part of the green paper, we actually did a survey on where companies believe they are on this curve. So what we saw is that a large number of insurers are somewhere in the initial and developing stages. You know, stages one and two, there are a few that are in the defined and advanced, but not many are leading stage at the moment. And on average, that diamond, 2.74, somewhere between developing and defined. That's where people currently are. When we asked, where would you like to be in 2 years' time? Very big shift towards defined and advanced and even leading stage. And you can see the average changed as well to closer to 3.62. So that is very ambitious goals. Clearly, everyone is putting a lot into analytics, and people want to gain a lot from their analytics strategy. So that then brought us onto the question is, well, are they actually achieving what they want out of this? And Deloitte did an EMEA-wide study, so they surveyed 68 insurers across the EMEA region, and they found that actually insurers are struggling to realize the true value of their data. So, in fact, almost 90% of insurers cannot identify the value from their investment in analytics, which is striking. And only 11% of respondents deem the analytics and business strategies to be fully aligned. So, again, that's clearly fairly alarming. There was a couple of other smaller points the topic, a little less conversation, a lot more action, that was the name of the survey and the paper that was released, but it speaks for itself. So some of the other findings were that data models do not exist or are unable to deliver business-wide value for 75% of insurers, and data is undefined or very poor quality for 40% of insurers. Now, it makes sense, right? We're dealing with legacy, fragmented systems. We're getting poor quality data. A disproportionate amount of time is spent manipulating data, improving, correcting data to actually get it to be fit for purpose, and therefore our data and our models are actually letting us down. In addition, data analytics remains fragmented across departments for majority of insurers. So few insurers have actually built enterprise-wide capabilities in an organized and tactical fashion. And then finally, analytics is not embedded into the strategic decision-making for over 60% of insurers. So decision-making remains largely driven by informed judgment rather than clear and comprehensive analysis. And this may be caused by lack of in-depth understanding at senior levels of how to leverage analytics, or perhaps the absence of enterprise-wide capabilities. So there's very clearly a disconnect between what we want to achieve and the results we're getting. So given this, we just thought, again, not to be a technical analytics paper, we'll give you a couple of examples of how insurers are using analytics in a different way to help influence outcomes rather than necessarily just to predict them. So the first example is a concept of called insurance as a service. And again, if you read the green paper, or if you came to any of those insight sessions, you will have seen me talking about this. One of the key findings was that as insurers get more detailed and specific information on individuals and on individual risks, they'll understand those risks better, and it'll enable them to produce more closely tailored and accurately priced products. So what does that mean? That means we have the ability now for better risk signaling. So closely tailored, accurately priced, ultimately today's consumer wants and expects personalization. And people want personalized experiences. So retailers say that the more personalized the experience, the happier the customer. And personalization is the key to loyalty, and obviously insurance is no difference to this. So consumers want tailored products, solutions, and or experiences, and how can we give that to them as insurers? How can we change the thinking that insurance is a product, rather insurance is actually could be a service? So the more insights we're able to get, the more we're able to be able to understand the risks to which individuals are predisposed, and potentially, therefore, how to mitigate them. And once we have this information and feed the information back, we're starting the loop of actually improving or correcting or changing behavior. So therefore, insurers can actually take a proactive role to reduce risk rather than their current reactive role, which is just coming in after the event and paying for the cost. Very quickly, a couple of examples of this. Driving habits, everyone knows about telematics devices that are being used to help risk rate and feedback information. One example I'll give you is Deloitte in the UK developed an app called HexScore. And Hex means they basically risk rate every square meter of road in the UK. Every hexagon of road, they risk rate according to, you know, how close it is to traffic lights, to schools, to where it is, traffic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They get basically up to a billion points of data and hundreds of variables, and they use it to risk rate each individual hexagon that you may drive over, and depending on which hexagons your route covers, they can therefore price you individually for your risk and feed back to you, oh, hold on, that route is less risky than that route, or et cetera. So that's on the telematics side. On the health and lifestyle side, again, there's been a lot of research into that actually health and lifestyle, or the risk of certain diseases, is actually more influenced by your health and lifestyle rather than by genetic predispositions. So if you change your ways, if you eat healthier, go to gym more often, sleep better, et cetera, you can actually influence your risk of getting certain diseases. And a good example of this is Vitality, which was pioneered by Discovery in South Africa. And their model is that feedback loop. So knowing and understanding your health, improving it, and therefore reaping the rewards. And Discovery claim that through independent research, they say Discovery members go to the hospital 7.5% less frequently and for noticeably shorter periods. Vitality clients are amongst the healthiest workplaces in America, so Vitality operates in America too. They remain customers for longer, so lower lapse rates, anywhere from 36 to 88% of non-participant lapse rates, and they claim less frequently. So there's definitely evidence there of lower loss ratios, lower lapse rates, so helping to reduce the risk of their portfolio. And on a side note, you know, people wearing these devices, getting the information, feeding it back to insurers, as I say, it allows the insurer to add more value to that relationship. So develop more of a customer relationship than just having more touch points rather than coming in just at the end when there's a claim. It can help change that relationship and rebrand insurance as a product that actually offers benefits in both life and death rather than just in death. Another two examples, which I won't talk about because we don't have time, but that is accessing genetic information and using that to understand risks to which you're predisposed and therefore tailoring treatment as a result, and connected homes and Internet of Things. So there's a whole bunch of connected devices, smart homes that are becoming available, smart cities. How do we use all that smart information? I mean, that's where the future of driverless cars is coming in. They're all going to be connected to each other, and that's going to allow us to avoid accidents because they'll be talking to each other. Likewise, in the house, you know, your fire extinguisher can be talking to something else, a smoke detector. So it's all about insurers being able to use data to mitigate risk. So those are my examples. I'll pass on to Bassem to talk about behavioral economics or another example.
Okay. So human behavior is an astonishingly complex topic. And if you think about it, a lot of the data being collected these days is trying to capture some sort of aspect of human behavior. A lot of the models being built these days are trying to predict an aspect of human behavior. So what if, and this is the thinking differently part, what if we were not only able to predict human behavior, but actually influence human behavior? And I guess that's where behavioral science comes in. And that's where behavioral science and analytics can work very, very well together. And that's what I want to focus on for the rest of the presentation. Specifically, I want to focus on what's been labeled as nudge theory. Can I just get a show of hands? Who's heard of nudge theory? Just to... Okay. So, nudge theory... Let me give you an example. This is a line from a movie. See if you can recognize this movie. Here's me planting an idea in your mind. If I say to you, don't think about elephants, what are you thinking about? I've just nudged you to think about something. Nudge theory was labeled by a guy called Richard Thaler in a very famous book, bestseller, that he brought out in 2008 called Nudge. Richard is actually a professor at the University of Chicago. The idea behind nudge theory is that nudge theory argues that by using positive reinforcement and indirect suggestions, you could have a much more effective impact on people's behavior than direct instruction, legislation, or enforcement. So by me suggesting something to you, that could influence your behavior a lot more than me imposing a law on you to do that thing, which is a fascinating topic. So examples, I'll give you practical examples. So people dislike making changes. That's just a common thing about humanity. We dislike changes. So why not set the optimal option as the default option? Example, in the office, let's put the default as double-sided printing. People dislike changes, so that should decrease use of paper. Another example, people have a tendency, a human tendency, to conform to social norms. So what happens if you tell people everyone else is doing it? Will that increase their likelihood of doing it as well? Another interesting fact about humans is that we hate being last. But when compared to others, we hate coming last. In fact, they ran an experiment where in a retail store, you're lining up to pay for something. If you're last in line, you're really annoyed, aren't you? I mean, we've all experienced this. You're really annoyed you're last. If someone just comes and stands behind you, you feel a lot better. Even though the waiting time hasn't changed, but you just feel like, I'm not last. So we hate being last. So what happens if you compare people to their peers and show them where they stand? Will that influence their behavior to act differently? Another interesting example is anchoring. So example, so you walk into a store, you want to buy a particular product, and you see on top of that product a sign saying, notice, maximum 8 products per customer. You'll think, well, wait a minute, maybe instead of buying one, I'll buy two. So the anchoring, basically by giving you a number, a high number, it anchors you to go higher than what you initially were planning to. So that's the idea of nudge theory. Let me show you some actual examples that have been used around the world. So here's a nudge. This was used in Hamburg when they were bidding for the 2024 Olympics. Now look at that image. This is the underground in Hamburg. Doesn't your focus automatically go to the stairs rather than the escalator? that's a nudge to make you take the stairs, and I think the stairs never looked so appealing. He's a very, very sophisticated nudge, came out of Amsterdam in Schiphol International Airport. They had a problem with urinals and spillages. So this Dutch economist thought of this brilliant nudge, right? And this nudge, by just basically putting a sticker in the urinal that looks like a fly, this nudge reduced spillages by 80%. Okay? I don't want anyone to ask me how they measured that. I don't want to talk about it. But 80% reduction in spillage. As it turns out, if you give men a target, they can't help aim at it. So there's a nudge for you. So one of the first applications of nudge theory came out of the UK. So around 2012. So what happens in the UK is the British government, if you're late paying your taxes, they'll send you a reminder letter reminding you to pay your taxes. So in the UK, they have a behavioural insights team that works for the government. So the behavioural insights team thought, why don't we take a randomly selected group of people who are late to pay their taxes, and we'll send them the standard letter, but we will add an extra sentence in that letter. The sentence said, 9 out of 10 people in your town, a specific town, they put the name of the specific town, pay their taxes on time. Okay? The amazing thing is, just by adding that one line for that group, that randomly selected group, tax compliance rates went up by 23%. Now think about that. Think about the implications of that. By simply changing your words and the way you interact with your customers, you could save your firm millions of dollars. So this is quite powerful. Many governments around the world are now utilising behavioural nudges. The US and the UK are world leaders in this space, but the New South Wales government as well, we have a number of behavioural insight units, and they've been around since 2012, and they work on such things as domestic violence, child support. So governments are probably the leaders in adopting this space, and firms are yet to follow. So a good example of using behavioural nudges with predictive analytics and the power you get out of that. The 2012 US presidential elections between President Obama and Romney, that was called the first big data election. What happened is that both Romney and Obama hired sophisticated teams of data scientists, and they were charged with one purpose, to build predictive models to optimise the efforts of the volunteer staff. So as you know, in the US, they have volunteer election staff that go and visit people and knock on doors. So they wanted to optimise the efforts of these people. Do they just go randomly and knock on doors? How do we make sure that they get the most out of their time? So this is how analytics and behavioural nudges can come together. The analytics, you build the models. They built the models to try to identify segments of the population that are most likely to swing either to Obama or Romney, because obviously there's no use going to a hardcore Obama supporter or a hardcore Romney supporter. So you want to identify those ones in the middle, on the edge, that you could tip either way. Once the models identified that group, then you send out your volunteers to go visit them. But what do you do? How do you nudge them to vote for Obama? These are some of the things they used. So they used commitment cards. So it's basically a card where you sign, you say, I commit to vote, and at the back they had a picture of President Obama. The reason why that kind of nudge works is that people are more likely to follow through on an action if they've committed to it. Another thing they did was they asked would-be voters to articulate a specific plan as to how they were going to vote on voting day. How they're going to get there, what time are they going to get there, which voting booth are they going to go to. Because again, if we articulate a plan in our mind, we're more likely to follow through with it. Another thing they use is they tell them that their neighbours are all voting for Obama to try to ignite that sense of following the norm and following social norms. So as you know, obviously Obama won that election, and by executing this analytics-based strategy coupled with behavioural nudges, they were able to get considerably more benefit from the time of the volunteers, more targeted, and as I was saying, rather than just predicting the outcome, they were able to influence the outcome. So I think that behavioural nudges and an understanding of behavioural science and human behaviour is an essential tool for any analytics professional to use. And some clever graphics. Basically, when you combine the two, the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts. So how does this work in actual practice then? Like if I was to actually do this in practice, how does it work? So very similar to the control cycle idea, the actuarial control cycle, is that what you do is you use randomized control trials where you basically model your population, you segment a certain segment of your population that you want to target. And I'll give more examples as to how to do this in practice, but just as the concept, you select your segment, and then you split that segment that you want to target into random groups. You have a control group with no nudges, and you apply different nudges to different groups. And then you test the results of the nudges, and you go back again and loop around and design different nudges until you come up with an optimal solution. Now, this idea of combining analytics with behavioral science, it basically, analytics effectively measure the impact of nudges. Because I was speaking to a psychologist at our firm in Deloitte, and he was saying to me, this is great because a lot of the times when we design nudges, there's no way for us to scientifically measure them. It's very rough. So by combining analytics, analytics can actually measure the impact of the nudges scientifically. You can also design the most effective nudge for certain groups. So if you're able to segment your population given certain variables, you can apply different nudges that will work differently for different groups. And then you can tailor-make a nudge for a specific group. So basically, data analytics will bring scientific rigor to the process of estimating an unknown quantity and making a prediction. And behavioral nudges will bring scientific rigor to the largely judgmental-driven approach of deciding how to prompt behavior change. And this has a lot of applications in insurance, given insurance is one of the big areas as actuaries working. Return to work outcomes, workers' compensation. Can you nudge workers to return to work quicker? Definitely you can. And there are some insurers that have employed that and gotten some very powerful results. Fraud detection. Can you nudge policyholders to commit less fraud? You definitely can. And I will talk you through an actual case study that we worked on at Deloitte that had, again, very, very powerful results. So this case study, actually some of our team members worked on this. This was out of the US. And we did a project for the government of New Mexico, the state of New Mexico in the US. Now, in the US, more than $4 billion worth of unemployment benefits go to people who are not eligible for unemployment benefits, who don't qualify. So you could call them fraudulent claims. The government of New Mexico wanted to tackle this problem because these missed payments, they make up one out of every $8 that goes to unemployment benefits. So how it works in the US is that when you lose your job, it's all done online. You don't need to go to the office anymore and apply. You apply online. So initially there's an application process where you go in and say, I've lost my job. And then week on week, every week you log back on to the website and you report your progress. How have you gone this last week? Have you looked for jobs? Have you had any interviews? Have you earned any income? And that's the process. And the payments get made straight into your bank account. So obviously, given that you're now dealing with a computer rather than a human being, the tendency to twist the truth a bit becomes a lot easier rather than the face of a human being. So we were asked to tackle this problem. So what Deloitte did is we worked with the Department of Workforce Solutions in New Mexico to identify the main areas of the application process where wrong information is usually given. And these were the areas that we identified. So number one, during the initial application process, when you inform the government that you've lost your job, they ask you, did you get laid off or were you terminated? Were you fired as a fault of your own or were you just made redundant? If you're fired in the US, you're not eligible for unemployment benefit. So obviously it's in your best interest to say, I got laid off. Right? So that was one area where they give false information. Another area, the weekly reporting of earnings. In the US, if I work 1 week and I earn $100, $100 get deducted from my benefits. So again, it's in my best interest to say I earned nothing to maximize my benefit. So that was another area. And again, they ask you for your work search activity during the week. How many jobs did you apply for? And if you haven't done two pieces of work search activity, like apply for at least two jobs, you're not eligible. So again, that was another area people could twist the truth in. So once those were identified, what do we do? Traditionally, what the government would do is they'd throw resources at it. Let's go investigate these people. But how would it work if you try to nudge people to do the right thing? So once the analytics predicted the people that are most likely to commit fraud, the nudge is kicked in. Let me talk you through an example, a real example. So I've lost my job, and I log onto the website, and I'm doing the initial application process, and it asks me, have you been fired or laid off? And I think, well, I was fired, but you know what, I think it was a bit unfair. I didn't deserve to get fired. So you know what? I'm going to say laid off. So I do that. All of a sudden, and this was the nudge that we applied. Once we identify a person as potentially fraudulent, what happens is a pop-up pops up on the screen with a letter addressed to your employer by name, asking about you by name and asking the employer to verify that you were actually laid off, not terminated. And basically we're saying, just FYI, this will be sent to your employer to verify that. Obviously, that's not a new thing. That used to always happen. The government used to always do that. But the amount of time it used to take for the letter to arrive to the employer and the employer to get back if they do respond, it could be months. So by just flashing that up on the screen, that was a very effective nudge for people to rethink and go back and actually say the truth. Then, you know, I've been unemployed for a few weeks and I'm going online every week to report my earnings. One week I go on and it asks me, have you earned any income over the last week? And I think, yeah, look, I mean, I worked at McDonald's a bit, but to be honest, that's just pocket money. It was nothing. You know, it's not even worth reporting. And plus, everyone else is doing it. I'm sure everyone else is working part-time and not reporting it. You know, once I get a full-time job, then I'll report it. I click, you know, no income. All of a sudden, a pop-up pops up on my screen that hasn't popped up before in the last few weeks that says to me, 99 out of 100 people in your state report their earnings accurately. Please report your earnings accurately. So what am I thinking? I've never seen this before, right? This is the first week that I see this. I think, oh my God, they're watching me. So it makes me think again. If that doesn't work, some follow-up questions pop up that I've never got in the weeks before, asking for more detail about my activity throughout the week. And again, we found that to be a very powerful nudge. All these things I'm describing, we've just tweaked the experience of the claimant. Just tweaked the experience. And the results were quite powerful. And without any extra resources being thrown at the problem. It's just small tweaks to the experience. Now, the work search criteria, what we implemented was a nudge to ask claimants to commit to what they're going to do in the following week. So we'll say, how are you going to apply for jobs? A newspaper, phone, internet, and they tick. Because again, going back to what I said earlier, if people commit to a plan, they're more likely to follow through. And we found some very powerful results. So I'll show you the actual results of the project. So we found that people were twice more likely to report new earnings accurately. They were half as likely to commit fraud and 20% more likely to find work in the next few months. And this project saved the government of New Mexico $2.3 million per annum. So as you can see, quite a powerful result combining behavioral nudges with predictive analytics. Okay. Now, not all analytics projects are this rosy. There's some very common pitfalls that you need to be aware of. Look, I think there's a lot of excitement these days around data, around the computing power available, around predictive analytics, and that's great. But sometimes I feel that the level of excitement outstrips our ability to recognize the limits of the tools we're dealing with. So I think it's always good to be aware of the limits of these models and the data before diving in and making assumptions. So, what does effective analytics look like? This is something that I think would be quite useful to think about. So analytics is made up of three components, effective analytics. Number one, you need maths and stats knowledge. Right? That's a must. Because with math and stats, you'll be able to analyze the data. That's just a given. On top of maths and stats, you need computing skills. Because the amount of data being generated these days is massive, you need computing power to handle that. Now, most importantly, what you need is domain knowledge. This is critical. And I'll tell you why. If I just combine maths and stats with computing skills, what I get is what's called machine learning. Right. Now, machine learning, I don't need to know what the data is. I can throw a data set at you with no labels for the variables. I'll just throw it, and I can run machine learning algorithms, and I'll tell you what's correlated to what. And I have no idea what the data is. Right? So that's machine learning. If I combine maths and stats with knowledge domain without computing power, I get traditional research. So I go out, I collect surveys, I analyze it, you know, manually without computing power. That's traditional research. Now, if I get rid of maths and stats, and all I have is domain knowledge, and computing skills, and I've got no idea about maths, that's the danger zone. Because I'm going to come up with some random, invalid results. The way to get effective data analytics is to combine those three. That's the way you get effect, the maximum effect from your data analytics. Now, I want to speak about this domain knowledge component, because that is critical. It's easy to get people who know computers, easy to get people who know maths and stats, but that domain knowledge, that understanding of the context, the nuances, that human touch that can't be replaced by a machine, in my opinion, although people are working very hard on it, but I don't think it's ever going to happen in our lifetime. That critical human element is a must for it to be successful in analytics. Let me show you a funny example, but I think it makes a point. Okay, so we graphed the number of movies that Nicole Kidman has released over the last few years. Okay, on top of that, we also looked at the number of male suicides throughout the same years. All right, huge correlation. Does that mean that Nicole Kidman's driving male suicide? Everyone has the same reaction you guys have. They laugh at first and they go, oh, actually, I mean, that movie Australia wasn't great, was it? But to come up with a conclusion that Nicole Kidman movies are driving male suicide, that lacks the understanding of the context and the domain expertise, we like to call it. Because data analytics is all about finding correlations between data sets. But you can get very, very random correlations that have nothing to do with anything if you're missing that human element. You can't follow models blindly. That's what I'm basically trying to say. If an insurance company comes out and says white cars have less accidents than red cars, okay, maybe there's a correlation there, but what's the context? What's happening there? You know, a very common example that people use is they say, as ice cream consumption increases, so do shark attacks. So you think, oh my goodness, let's stop selling ice cream. But there's usually, with these random examples, there's usually a third variable that's correlated to both, the temperature. Right? So in order to understand that third variable, you need to understand the context that you're dealing with. And again, that's that human touch that can't be replaced. You can't assume causation from correlation, as we all know. Causation is always context-specific. Correlation isn't. And that's where the human element comes in. We at Deloitte have developed this concept of purple people. And what we mean is red, the red side, red people are very technical people. They're your data scientists. They know models. They know SAS. They know this. They know that. Great. The blue people are the business people. They don't know all the technical stuff. They just know what needs to be done in the business and the business processes. What we need is purple people. People who are able to bridge the gap between the red and the blue, between the technical and the business, who can speak both languages, who can speak to the techie guys and explain what they want, and speak to the business and understand what they want and bridge that gap. So I guess actuaries need to bring out their purpleness, because I think that's where we can add a lot of value. And we should be trying to build purple people in our organizations. It's often very hard to find these purple people. They're few and far between. However, one step, intermediate step, if you can't find purple people, at least try to build purple teams. A mix of red and blue people working together to make a purple team. Now, it's important to remember that essentially all models are wrong, but some are useful. Again, we can't rely too heavily on models. Often we get excited about the models, and we think the model's everything, but we have to realize the limitations of the model. You know, an example, I was talking to a data scientist who does recommender systems. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of recommender systems. So, example, Netflix. They recommend movies to you based on what you've watched before. Now, that's an algorithm running in the background trying to predict the most likely movie you will watch next. So usually they put the number one recommendation as the most likely, number two, and so on. So these data scientists were building models trying to come up with a recommendation algorithm. They were trying to refine and refine and refine, and again, it wasn't performing that great. So then they thought, why don't we try what's called result dithering? And basically what that means, let's accept that the model's not perfect, it's not going to give us perfect results, and why don't we throw in a random component in there that just mixes up so the model will come up with recommendations, what it thinks are the right recommendations. We'll add a random component that mixes up the results a little bit. And obviously you can tweak that random component, turn that up and down. They applied that result dithering. They were saying that out of all the stuff they tried to make the model perform better, that was the most effective way to make the result of the model better. That to me says that to get the maximum benefit out of the models and the data, you need to understand that they are limited, they're not perfect. before assuming that they are. Okay, so my last point. Often we as technical people, I don't know whether it's our, the way we're trained, the way we're programmed, often we're always occupied as actuaries with how do I solve this problem, right? How do I solve it? What's the best way to solve it? But maybe we should be focusing more on why should I solve this problem? As in, what's my objective? Like, what am I doing here? My objective is not just to build a clever model. That's not the objective. You know what my objective is? My objective is action. I need the business to do something to solve the problem. Action, hopefully with insight, insightful action. That's my objective. I'm trying to solve a problem always, but the problem needs an action to solve it. Like, I can come up with the most interesting insight in the world, but if the business can't use it, it's a useless insight, literally. It's a useless insight. Like, we heard yesterday about the Netflix example, how Netflix ran a competition. The prize was $1 million to come up again with the best recommender system. And the guys that won it, that we heard yesterday, was a very diverse team, and they threw in about over 100 algorithms to improve Netflix original model by 10%, right? And they won $1 million. But what we didn't hear yesterday is, do you guys realize that Netflix never implemented that model? They actually never did. The reason why, they said it was too complex, it didn't fit their business model, and plus the business had moved on since the competition anyway. Before they were looking at DVDs, now they're looking at streaming, so they never implemented the $1 million solution that won the competition. So that shows you that our objective is action with insight. The solution needs to be deployable, needs to be implementable, it needs to be interpretable, we can be able to interpret it, and it needs to be repeatable in the business. And often the simplest model is actually the most useful model rather than the most complex model. And one thing just to leave you with, action with a little bit of insight is always better than no action with all the insight in the world. And thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you to Basim and Mark for their presentation. I think we've got a room full of purple people here, hopefully. And we only have about 5 minutes, so if anyone has any questions, if you'd like to come to the microphone. And if not, maybe I'll just start by asking you a little bit more about the ethical side of nudging people and, I guess, pushing them towards decisions that may be in a corporate's interests rather than necessarily the client's interests. Do you want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's a common concern, but I guess I don't have an answer, but just a few points to think about in answering this question is, number one, I think, as with all things in life, you can use things for good or evil, right? So we advocate nudging for good, as we say. But another thing to keep in mind as well is that this nudging principle is actually not new. If you think about it, everyone's trying to nudge you. Marketing people are trying to nudge you. Governments are trying to nudge you. Everyone's trying to nudge you. And another thing to keep in mind is that nothing is forced on you. It's a free choice. So you're not forcing anyone to do anything. It's a free choice. And obviously, if things do get out of hand, the government can step in and regulate. Like, for example, tobacco advertising. You know, before they were trying to nudge you to smoke, the government stepped in now and said, no, we're going to nudge you to not smoke by putting those disgusting pictures on the packs that you buy. So I guess, yeah, just things can be used for good and evil. We advocate nudging for good. But if anyone has any thoughts, I'd be happy to hear them.
One of the biggest new roles in the future is not going to be, maybe purple people, but also ethicists, because when we come to computing power, that's going to be another thing that we have to tackle as people, because, yes, everyone does try to do it, but they've been very ineffective because they didn't take the behavioural science into account, and now we can actually be much more effective about nudging people. People on your team, maybe you need purple people, and maybe you need an ethicist or a philosopher to join teams too, to help us make the right decisions.
Can you just say your name as well?
Sorry, Louise Bain from AMP.
Thanks. Does anyone else have any comments from their own experience or questions for Mark and Basim? Yep.
Anthony Ma from Quantium. We do a lot of work with data analytics, and we do operate on the assumption, I guess, that people want personalised experiences, as you mentioned. But I find invariably, whenever I talk to someone about what we do, they feel totally uncomfortable with the idea of, you know, these companies following them around and looking at everything they've purchased and things like that. So there seems to be a bit of a disconnect on what we assume when we're doing this work compared to what people are saying. And I don't know if you guys have got any comment on whether or not people are sort of conflicted in their minds about what they think they want and what they actually want with regards to getting that those sorts of personalised messages.
I think it's definitely a challenge that I've seen again with the Vitality program. You get those people who are that way inclined and are keen to do it, to share their data, put on their wearables, connect them, and then you just get those people who say, I don't want that insurer having my data. And it's very difficult to sort of sway everyone, right? But what often happens is, as time goes on, as with everything, some people are resistant to ideas in the beginning. As it becomes more mainstream, even similar to the behavioral economics, 9 out of 10 people do this. As more people start doing and adopting, as it becomes, let's say, for example, in insurance, we start giving discounts. You know, some people, maybe the money doesn't mean anything, but a lot of people it will. And so people will start moving because money talks, right? And the more people that start moving towards giving up their data, you know, I'm one personally, I'm very hesitant to give up my data. I don't want insurers having everything, but I see a lot of my friends around me doing it, and I think, yeah, probably in time I'll do it too. So it's one of those things that either you'll move with the times, but you're always going to get those people that are going to be sort of resistant, I think.
So just one more point on that. I think as well it's important to show customers that there's value. I think the problem is I'm not seeing any value and you're just watching me. So I think we have to highlight, like, putting the customer first. There's actually value in this. You know, we're actually going to understand you better and offer you a more tailored product. So I think by coming at it that way, but as Mark said, look, it's going to take time. It is a new concept and it is freaky when you think about it. Yes.
Young from BT Financial Group. Thanks for that. Just a comment in relation to that. Maybe companies need to find ways to build trust so that we will be comfortable in sharing our data with, you know, that company. So how do we, you know, maybe we can do that.
And perhaps some ways is to really clarify to consumers how the data is being used, what it's being used for, and what it won't be used for. Because sometimes also people overthink what their data might actually be used for. Actually, if you say, we're collecting your data for the following purpose, it will not be used for anything else. It will not be passed on to anyone else. It will be kept secure, et cetera, et cetera. It might put people a lot more at ease to give up that information.
No, it sounds to me like someone with a bell is trying to nudge us out of the room. So with that in mind, I'd just like to all of you to join me in thanking the guys for their presentation. We'll present them both.